And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Want an easy way to stay up to date with the latest news and trends in the NBA? Listen to the NBA Daily Ding podcast Monday through Friday. Wake up and turn up the NBA Daily Ding to stay informed on all things NBA here at The Athletic and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to Tampering.
For this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Amick.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Was it right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention Deans anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
The trial you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Hey, we don't know how to tamper with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast. I'm Sam Amick, NBA national writer at The Athletic, here as always with my guys on the East and the West. We got Fred Katz. We got Anthony Slater. We're going to talk playoffs and all the drama in the second round on the back end of this week's pod. But we are going to bring a friend of the show and a fantastic colleague in today to talk all things Dallas Mavericks. I teamed up with Mavs beat writer Tim Cato on a story that came out today, diving into the politics of the Mavs and the overarching question of when you have a player as great as Luka Doncic, you know, is the environment around him such and healthy enough and synergistic enough to get the most out of this Luka Doncic era? And we focused on Bob Bulgaris, who has been with the team for several years, was hired as the director of quantitative research and development, a former professional gambler, a guy who NBA Twitter is well aware of, has been, you know, on a public stage for quite some time, but has a ton of influence with the Mavs. We tried to pull the curtain back on those dynamics. Tim, how are you? Thanks for joining us, brother.
What's up, boys? I'm doing good.
Appreciate you, man. Great job on the piece. You know, I mean, you and I obviously have been working on this for weeks, and I do admittedly love what we do at our place when it comes to, you know, I already kind of said it, but pulling the curtain back and trying to explain to the fans and the readers the power structures and how things truly operate for all these teams. And so with the Mavs, you know, when you have a front-facing owner like Mark Cuban, whose profile is obviously through the roof, then I think folks rightfully assume that his fingers are in everything, but it's a lot more complicated than that with this group. You got Donnie Nelson's been there a long time in the front office. Rick Carlisle, you know, wins that title about a decade ago and is now one of the longest tenured coaches in the league. And so a lot of familiar faces. Bob was not a familiar face. He's not somebody who the mainstream fans are aware of. Take us through the piece a little bit. When did you start thinking that his influence and his situation was worth exploring? And what did you learn?
Right. I think the idea that the front office has not lived up to Luka's end of the bargain, if you will, like he's ready to win now. And you saw in game seven, I felt like the Clipper series was an indictment on the job they've done. You know, he had what, 46 and 14, and the game wasn't even close at the end. Kawhi Leonard was subbing out because, you know, the game was in hand. The idea that the front office has been an issue is something that's been there. And I started hearing that there were specifically issues within it months ago and all around the league. I mean, I think league and team and there's a lot of people just concerned with the direction it was taking, with the idea that, you know, that this Luka timeline is now, and nobody wants to look back in a few years and say we messed that up, that we annoyed the, you know, a generational player who they were fortunate enough to draft, wanted to draft, but certainly fortunate in some ways as well. nobody wants to look back on a moment like this, on an opportunity for a team that has not won a playoff series since the 2011 title, and say, man, we messed this up too. And now Luka wants to go somewhere else. Now he wants out. Now he, you know, is just not satisfied with the team, with the roster being built around him. And I think that's where a lot of this was built and based off of. And it kind of went from there over time, as the, you know, it became clear that, you know, there were so many competing interests, and there was, you know, just confusion about how the league even viewed the Mavericks front office, who actually held power, who was the people to talk to for this or that. You know, it was a consistent, you know, concern and buzz that was building and building and building over time. And so that's when I really tried to start reporting this as well as I could. Talked to a lot of people throughout the league. You know, there was eventually, you know, people on the team who shared these concerns and had their own you know, details and things to share. And that's, you know, kind of the genesis of the story and how it led to the piece that we published this morning.
Just a quick or a couple of quick overarching thoughts for me, and then I would definitely want to hear Fred and Slater's take on this. For one, it speaks to Luka's greatness early on that, you know, that this is even a story, because as we reported, you know, he is widely expected to sign that Supermax extension, but, you know, his talent is on the kind of level where if you are trying to replicate a Dirk Nowitzki type experience, then he's so good that you're already thinking about the next contract. And so it's funny, even as I looked at our piece, I'm thinking, if I'm a reader, I'm confused. Like, well, wait, you said he's signing, so what am I worried about? It's like, well, because that's when a guy's this good, you got to think about the long road. The other thing is that, you know, I'm admittedly kind of shamelessly patting our company on the back and our platform, I guess, is that like these types of people in some form or fashion exist with every single team. And I love the fact that, you know, that we so routinely try to get into some of these things. You know, if you ask other teams about trade rumors or different things around the league, other teams are constantly trying to figure out who's actually making the call, who actually has the juice. And there are these somewhat mysterious characters throughout the NBA that even the executives themselves are trying to learn about, because they don't ever want to waste any time on the phone with somebody who claims that they're making the calls and they're not. And so in that regard, you know, I mean, I already got some feedback today from around the league where folks were surprised that Bob hadn't been front and center even earlier. So again, great job on the piece. Fred and Anthony, I don't know who wants to dive in, but again, you guys have been through this with the teams you cover, but in general, kind of how did the piece in this situation hit you?
Well, one of the interesting parts about it is, like, it, you know, from reading it, it's not just a front office thing, right? This bleeds into the coaching staff and Carlisle and lineup decisions. And how much is that a clash, would you say? I mean, and it seems, you know, through you know, reading your guys' reporting, like there's been tense moments with Rick and questions about his future with Dallas. And what, at this point, what is he, like the second longest, third longest tenured coach in the NBA?
Right. Yeah. Third, it's Popovich. And then he's essentially tied for second with Spoelstra. Yeah. It's no secret that Luka and Rick have clashed in butted heads. This has been reported on ad nauseum. We certainly added reporting to that, to those facts and to the idea that Rick is somebody whose role is being considered, is being looked at. I don't think, and we say in the piece, we're not questioning his acumen as a basketball coach. He's clearly very good strategically. But, you know, the idea that, you know, if you're not going to get along with the best player, if the best player is someone who is not routinely listening to you, that's a concern. That you know, that adds to this entire dynamic that, you know, you need to be sure you're doing what you need to do to make sure that you maximize the Luka timeline. And if that comes to coaching, like, that's also a concern. That's something that you have to consider, you have to view, and you have to think about, all right, you know, what, you know, is this relationship manageable or tenable going forwards? Is this something that, you know, needs to be addressed? And I think that's where we tried to land on the piece. You know, it wasn't, you know, all things considered, you read the piece, I don't think you should come away from it thinking that Carlisle has been the problem on this team per se. You know, I again, he is tactically, I think he's consistently gotten more out of a roster and a group of players over his entire tenure. But if you know, whatever, for whatever reason, if he doesn't clash with the star player, even if he's tried to openly and accurate, you know, very clearly tried to adapt his style and how he coaches this team to build around him, you know, are you certain that's still working? Are you certain that he's done enough to make that a reasonable and, you know, productive relationship going forwards? And I think that's mostly what got called into question and throughout the reporting and the publishing of this piece. And I think that's probably the takeaway that should be had after reading this.
So on that note, we've all covered different kinds of front offices, and I'm sure we've all heard stories from around the league about anywhere from meddlesome front offices to front offices who just let the rest of the guys in the organization do their thing and whatever they want to call it. They're laissez-faire. They're, you know, collaborative tends to be a very buzzword that we hear around the league all the time, right? And when you hear stories about front offices that are meddlesome, it's almost always coming from the top. And you often hear pushback. You know, a front office will come in and say, you got to play this guy more. And the coach says, no, here's why I'm not playing this guy. And there's often pushback. And sometimes it's a very healthy pushback. And that's a great kind of clash that you actually want, because that's where ideas stem from. And other times it turns personal or unprofessional or whatever you want to call it. What I'm curious is, Rick Carlisle is known as being a guy who wants to coach the way that he wants to coach. And unlike a lot of guys who want to coach the way they want to coach, he has the resume to back it up. He's coached numerous NBA teams. He's had success in numerous destinations. I mean, I don't know if the average fan realizes how rare it is to be a coach with a ring. Like, so few coaches around the league have actually coached teams to a ring. And he did it and has consistently coached good teams and been well-respected around the league. How does he react when the person who's meddling is not even just somebody from the front office telling him, this is the better way to do your job, here are the rotations, here's how you should be coaching this situation, when that person isn't just from the front office, but is also somebody who is, you know, technically not in charge of the front office, is technically not the highest up person in the hierarchy.
And tied to ownership too, which is always its own thing.
I mean, Tim's the expert there. My quick response to that question, Fred, would be that, for one, I mean, one thing I've learned about Rick over the years and heard in spades and doing reporting for this piece is that, I mean, to quote the story, we had an anonymous quote, you know, the R-rated version, was that he's adaptable as a motherfucker. Like, and it made me laugh because it kind of gets to the heart of how Rick has had this ability to read the room with the Mavs all the way through his tenure. So he, you know, had some friction with Jason Kidd. And like we had in the piece, you know, his assistant coaches had to go to him and essentially say, you know, Dirk is all in on Jason. You're not winning this one. Fall in line. Don't be so controlling, you know, and he did, and then win a championship. Well, you know, then we saw the opposite of that with Rajon Rondo. That was laid bare. We saw when Carlisle, you know, saw that he could win that battle. And he kind of put Rajon out there publicly at the time. This one with Luka, but we've been hearing since last year that Rick was well aware, like, you're not winning this with Luka. And by, when I say winning this, I simply mean, you know, picking and choosing your spots on how stubborn you're going to be, whether it's play calling, whether it's timeouts, whether it's, okay, you're doing this thing and that thing that are irritating Luka. Rick then gets to decide how much he cares. Well, if it wasn't Luka, then he doesn't care. If it's, you know, Tim Hardaway Jr., it's a different response. And so, but to your specific question, Rick knows that Bob is obviously empowered by Mark, and he is, you know, essentially part of the front office. And that's where Mark is, I think, such an interesting guy in general, because, you know, he's got these people running his organization and like a level of stability that you don't see very often in the NBA with the Donnie Nelsons and the Carlisles around him. But then, you know, you have a little bit of an unorthodox approach with Bob and somebody that he clearly trusts and wants to be part of the decision-making process. So that's kind of how I see all that.
Right. And we've reported that players felt like, you know, these rotations that were being set up and shared were rigid to the point that it prevented them from being as good as they could be, that they could be, you know, they were frustrated. There was a lot of frustration within the locker room and it stemming from that. I'll note that we did not report that Rick and Bob had a bad relationship. As far as I know, you know, like you could probably infer to some degree that, you know, if Rick was really being, you know, his hand was being held in some ways, that he wouldn't like that. You know, we all know Rick Carlisle. But I also think that Bob in some ways is very good at his job and that he has good, smart ideas about how to manage stuff. The problem becomes if it's so direct and it's so unflexible, unrigid, or is unrigid, I suppose. And, you know, to the point that players feel like their roles are not even being assigned from the person who is, you know, in charge of coaching them. Yeah, that's going to be an issue. That has been an issue in the locker room. And that's you know, the real concern that I think I took away from that specifically is just how it, you know, how these, you know, overarching decisions, even if Rick is someone who's like, oh, this makes sense and this is smart and I am going to do it this way, because Rick absolutely is someone who, you know, has a, you know, he's really embraced, I think, analytics and embraced a new age and style of basketball. He's the one who went on that whole rant about Kristaps Porzingis and saying that post-ups are not a good play anymore. I absolutely think that, you know, probably most of what Bob said resonated with him to some degree. But when it reaches a point where the players are like, well, you know, you're just doing this because this other guy above you said to do this, and this other guy above you has ownership ties that we don't even understand, that's when it reaches a point where, you know, people want to say something about it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Tim. I think, again, I'm being somewhat repetitive, but, like, you know, without putting the team name on it, I'm thinking of this one team in particular that where I know their analytics guy pretty well. And, like, in another life where he was given the kind of power that it appears Bob has been given, I guarantee you that when there's a person who works remotely from his team who the players don't personally know, and let's say they caught wind of the fact that he was making these kinds of key day-to-day crucial decisions, that would absolutely spark, you know, some kind of uprising in the locker room. And I think there's an element of that here. I think a lot of, honestly, the push of even the story coming to light is admittedly coming from the player community. And it's well beyond Luka when it comes to the Mavs locker room. There was this growing sense that, you know, the players were questioning, you know, why they were being asked to do certain things. And Tim, you hit it on the head that, you know, it's Rick, are you pulling the strings here or is somebody a puppet master for you? And I know that's overly simplistic, but those are the dynamics. And Tim, I wonder, like, I know this is, again, probably way too simplistic, but would you agree or not that there's an element here of, if you go back all the way to when Michael Lewis wrote Moneyball, I mean, the Art Howe, Billy Beane dynamic where, you know, the old A's manager, you know, was, and at that time, Billy obviously was running the front office legitimately, but, you know, Art, and just that idea that old school sports folks have continued to try to figure out how to work with a quasi new age voices and minds to get the most out of these sports organizations. Those themes continue to this day, and I think exist in this story.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that, you know, there is a lot of concern, you know, high level people, you know, good sourcing says that, you know, just the way that, you know, this vision was presented. I'm very analytical in the way I view basketball. But yeah, you need a way to talk to players that it's received and not just seen as this is what the numbers are telling us to do. And so you need to go do that. And I think the reporting is very clear that Bob wasn't able to communicate those things when he did have interactions with players and in a way that was effective or really brought up a you know, a good image around him. And then, you know, in a lot of ways, people kept looking at him and kept saying, you know, this is a problem. And yeah, it's hard. It's a hard thing to, it's a hard line to walk, for sure. It's like you said, how many stories of analytics guys not meshing with, you know, sports guys have we heard throughout the past 2 decades? I mean, a million. It feels like a million. And so I think that is definitely an underlying through line or a through line that kind of goes through this reporting and this piece and everything that's come of it.
That's why Tim and I don't get along. I'm a big sports guy. We just don't do it.
There you go.
Well, I just don't like Fred. You know, there's really no reason behind it except that
Sam, it's funny that you mentioned the Moneyball stuff, because when I was reading the Carlisle stuff, what came to me is I wonder if this would have the same sort of if this would be received in a similar way if it were about a baseball team, because it's funny in terms of you know, front office coaching dynamics in baseball. It's kind of progressed to a point where front offices are dictating so many in-game decisions. And it's easier to do that in baseball because the game stops. You can actually come and you can make a decision, and a free-flowing game, it's a lot more difficult for a coach to have that sort of impact on decision-making. But you know, the game has changed in baseball towards that degree, and baseball's analytics movement is obviously farther along than any other sports that I follow, at least of the major sports. And that includes basketball. And so do you guys think that this sort of dynamic, as analytics continue to become more prominent, do you guys think that this is some sort of inherent attribute of analytics? And I don't know if you know the answer to this, but if this is some sort of inherent attribute of analytics run front officing, or is this a sort of coincidence that we've been seeing this progressively more and more with more and more organizations in baseballs where baseball teams are kind of, they're hiring managers now as guys who can be communicators to players of the analytics. And they're openly saying, this is the guy who can communicate these decisions to the players. He's a player manager. And we're going to let our front office basically dictate, all right, set decision, first and second, one out. You got a guy who throws a lot of sliders on the mound. Here's what we're going to do. Do you think that we're trending into more of a direction like that in basketball as analytics become more prominent?
I do. I would agree with you. I think part of what you alluded to, Fred, is that baseball is certainly ahead of basketball when it comes to, you know, that movement. And I learned recently that even if you talk about staffing, you know, league-wide, I just think the numbers in baseball trump basketball to a pretty significant degree. But I think the advancement has been there in hoops. One guy who I think about, who I actually would credit for doing it pretty well. So Monty McNair was running analytics at a high level for the Houston Rockets. And a couple of years ago in the playoffs, the Rockets helped me out with the story I was trying to do. And they gave me access during the playoffs to their coaches' meetings. And I got to see in person Monty, who is, for lack of a better way of putting it, like, he's capable of acting like a normal human. He's a nice guy. He can communicate. And he was really adept at getting, you know, his message analytically across to Mike D'Antoni specifically. And they had a rapport that I thought served the organization well at that time. And then now, you know, he's running the Kings, obviously. And I think from a communication standpoint, has those kinds of skills. But I think that hoops is behind baseball again. And I also think that, and Tim, I'm curious to hear you on this, like, there's something, perception is everything, right? So I definitely think there's something to Bob's background as a gambler, I think, is coming into play here. I think you have certain stereotypes that come with the gambling industry. And I'm talking about from the vantage point of the players. You know, if you're just a guy in the Mavs locker room and all you heard is that some gambler is determining your playing time, your thought process might not go any farther than that. And I think that might be one thing that doesn't help his cause, and it, you know, distinguishes him from the other analytics crowd.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, he's built up a reputation over time. Like, he's promoted his own public image. Like, I think I became aware of him specifically from, you know, the Bill Simmons podcasts and things like that. And, you know, the idea that this person who, you know, has sent tweets himself, hit send on them, that, you know, certainly read in an arrogant way at times. You know, there's instances where I've, you know, seen that and just been like, I don't know how, if you're expressing this thing about crypto or whatever in this way, I have no clue how you could express, right. You know, if this is how you express player, you know, basketball analytics to players and things like that, there's no way it's going to be taken well. And that's, right. That's what we heard. That's what we heard consistently. You know, he wasn't communicating with them all the time. You know,
I'm literally getting text messages right now from people about how they've never liked his style, which is, I know that's right. A general characterization, but I think personality is coming into play here.
right?
Well, Luka clearly didn't, and that's the big one, right? I mean, as we talk about the difference between basketball and baseball, one of the big differences is it's not even communicating as much to a team of baseball players. It's the star in the NBA. It's the one player, and I mean, you guys laid it out in your lead. I mean, Luka doesn't seem to like how you know, he handles his business.
Right, and you know, that's as Luka does, Luka goes, the Mavericks go. Like, you know, this is now the central figure of the Mavericks, not you know, even more than I think Cuban, certainly more than Bob, Rick, Donnie, anybody else involved. You know, it is Luka who holds the power. And you know, we aren't, you know, we never reported and we aren't saying that, you know, he's out here trying to flex that power and you know, get, you know, I think the fact that he immediately set out, you know, came out and said that he's going to sign his extension, you know, he could have held on to that. He could have waited.
100%.
He could have held that over the team. And I think it's clear he didn't. But the idea that the Mavericks are not considering Luka in every decision they make from this point out, of course they are. They have to be. That's the reality of a basketball team that has a star as big as him. And that's how the NBA works at this point.
Can I ask you guys about the one name we haven't said much, Kristaps Porzingis, who to me, a lot of times angst within organizations come from big moves that don't go well. Even if at the time it seemed like a great swing trade, it just hasn't worked out that great. I mean, if you obviously just kind of outside looking in, look at the roster and the issues in the playoffs, to me, the big glaring one is their number two is not close to a number two right now. As we, you know, you spin this forward and you wonder who has the power in this organization as it moves into this offseason, the next one. I mean, Porzingis is the big question mark in the move. I mean, like, where are you guys at on his situation and who ultimately is going to make the decision on what to do with him?
When I first started hearing whispers about things, you know, not going well behind the scenes, that's what I assumed it was. I assumed it was Luka and KP or something that had happened there. That turned out not to really be the case. I've consistently heard and reported weeks ago about how, you know, if there is concerns about their relationship, it stems over just, you know, their ability to share, as you know, not be the 1A 1B that Kristaps wanted, you know. And you know, this was ESPN reported something similar, and so it's not that, but you know, the idea that KP hasn't been the 1B that he was expected to be, it's a real concern. I've always liked, maybe this is my analytics brain, just that, you know, there's no such thing as another 7-3 shooter who used to play really high level defense in the league. You know, there's no such player that they're going to go replace him with. Like, he is, you know, to the point that he is a unicorn, it's true given his skill set. The problem is that he hasn't, you know, lived up to these expectations. He hasn't been quite as good of a shooter as the team would have hoped. Certainly the defense regressed majorly this year, and that's been a concern, even if he did, you know, have some better moments in the final few games of their first round loss to the Clippers. And yeah, that's a big concern. And so, you know, I like what he represents to basketball. I like what Kristaps could represent to basketball. And so I've always been, you know, rooting for him, you know, not that I'm rooting against anybody. But the idea that, yeah, you know, Luka and him have not worked as a partnership to the degree that the Mavericks hope for, that's a real concern. And it's probably the biggest question around the Mavericks going forwards, even bigger than front office stuff. It doesn't matter. It matters, you know, what you need to do is get it right. And the front office stuff underlies all this, who is making the decisions, who is trusted to make these decisions. But what they do with Porzingis, whether he can bounce back, whether he could even rebuild trade value so that he is somebody who could be traded down the road and hopefully, you know, be a player that, you know, turns into something that, you know, turns into another player that is more of a fit next to Luka. I think that's what you have to think about with this franchise as you kind of look at their future and whether they are going to build up a team that is good enough for Luka, that does connect and have synergy with Luka and is able to push this team to, you know, a contending status that they really haven't been since the 2011 championship.
Yeah, that's the one. If I'd be worried if I was in their shoes, because I hear you for sure, Tim, on what Porzingis is and what he could be. And you're dead on that. You just can't, you know, those kind of guys don't grow on trees. But I mean, when postseason he's coming out fairly candidly with the types of talking points that make you wonder of just about where his head is at, it can't be easy to go from being the darling of the New York Knicks, you know, Phil Jackson's great find and a guy that is, you know, at the time before his injury was expected to lead a franchise himself, to now being told like, well, we love you, but we love you in this role. And we're going to put a ceiling on what you might've thought you were capable of in your past life. But, you know, we hope this works. And so I wonder a little bit about his mindset going forward, because if that piece doesn't work, and if that trade value doesn't, you know, kind of get reborn a little bit here in the near future, then they're in a tough spot. We've seen already two postseasons in a row that Luka can be the kind of the second coming, and, you know, it's a team game. It only matters so much. I mean, it's wild that the narrative, rightfully so, around Luka is so positive in regards to his play. And again, it's well-deserved, but, you know, the harsh reality is he's still sitting home right now when, and I've joked with the guys before that it's, you know, that, hey, DeAndre Ayton's out here, Trae Young's out here. Like, these guys are with their teams deeper in the playoffs. And so there is pressure on the Mavs. They got it right getting Luka, and, you know, but he's a title contending type player, and we'll see if they can build around him. Tim, great work on the piece. I know you have another pod to get to, and it's a busy day for you, but thank you very much for coming on. Again, job well done, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, fellas.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Good stuff, guys. Before we move on to playoff talk, any final thoughts on the Mavs front? Because like we hit on, it's, you know, it's the kind of thing that there's a lot of league-wide themes. These are not new problems for owners and front office folks to figure out. Well, what do you guys think?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, I just think they're one of the most interesting teams in the league from a team building perspective. I mean, they got Hardaway coming up. They traded a couple of picks to get Porzingis. Like Slater said, Porzingis took a step back this year, and you don't know how much of it has to do with this is who he is now versus he's still somewhat working his way back from, you know, bad injuries. And, you know, he's still young enough to where he can conceivably get better. And even if he is a little bit worse after the injuries, learn how to play with that sort of physical skill set. They are a really fascinating team building team because Luka, while he is great, to maximize him, you want to play a specific particular way where you put the ball in his hands and you have guys around him. And, you know, you guys talked about it in your story of running high pick and rolls and letting him facilitate and create offense for your guys. And it is going to be a really, really interesting team building experience to watch how Dallas puts that together and tries to build a title contender, because they're very good, but, you know, they're a little bit hamstrung in terms of what they're going to be able to do. It's not like they can just go out and get somebody right now.
Right.
What would even be the answer on Porzingis? I mean, you almost, if you were going to give up on him, you'd probably have to do like a bad contract swap. I know people have mentioned like a Kemba for Porzingis, McCollum for Porzingis. I don't know which, you know, what way an asset would be going. I've had people ask me about the Warrior situation, like an Andrew Wiggins for Porzingis type thing. Wiggins had a better season than Porzingis, which is crazy. And they're basically under the same contract. That's a problem for them. It's why they don't have their first round pick this year. You know, that's going to New York. And at the time, it seemed like a great deal, but that's kind of, it's really handcuffing them. And I don't know how much of the front office angst has to do with that or not, but it's, that is the situation to solve moving forward.
They're going
to
be an interesting player in 2022 also, because they can create max cap space next summer. And, you know, Luka's certainly good enough to get somebody to want to go play
there. Oh, yeah.
Lord knows.
That's a strong way to finish. And a great point, Fred, is from a free agency standpoint, you know, I feel like he's the kind of guy that, you know, there's going to be a magnet. I think maybe some players, I mean, his usage is fairly high. And so who knows, maybe not everybody wants to play with him, but in terms of his spirit and his personality and the joy, you know, I know it's a little corny when we bring stuff like that up, but Slater, you cover a guy in Steph Curry who I've always thought that, you know, his joy is contagious and that people want to be around that. And Luka has that same quality. Let's segue here. One organization that does not seemingly have any such structural power problems would be the Phoenix Suns, the once flailing Robert Sarver owned, you know, a long time struggling Phoenix Suns. And here they are, guys, Western Conference Finals. First time, I believe, since 2011. Am I accurate on that?
2010. 2010 was the last time they were in the playoffs.
So that
actually, and they made the conference finals.
Yeah. So that was the Alvin Gentry led Phoenix Suns. I covered that series. I have no complaints, by the way, of returning to the Valley of the Sun to cover a series. I'm looking forward to that.
Amy's going to live it up in Scottsdale.
I got a few Scottsdale memories. So in fact, I booked the hotel last night, so that'll be fun. But you talk about organizational dynamics, and we've talked before on the pod, but, you know, I think it is time that you know, we got to give credit where credit is due, because, you know, we're here analyzing Mark Cuban's movements with the Mavs, you know, and Robert Sarver did a wise thing by hiring Monty Williams and even before that, hiring James Jones to run the front office with Jeff Bauer. And that combo, by the way, has been really good. Like, you got Jeff, who's a lifer as an executive, and a guy who, in terms of the machinations and cap gymnastics and all the above, you know, and relationship stuff too, Jeff's very strong. But James Jones is coming at it from a different angle, and I think has been really productive, and I think played a part in hiring Monty Williams and then eventually trading for Chris Paul and convincing Devin Booker to be patient. They put it on the Nuggets. I mean, they look like a really, really dangerous team even more than before. Chris Paul, Slater, like you wrote, is looking healthier by the day, just a master of the mid-range, and the Nuggets, you know, whimpered into the offseason. But how are we seeing these Suns?
Favorites in the West, it seems like. I mean, you know, they're about to get, what, 8 days off between series. Paul already, clearly the rest time, or whatever you want to call it, the time between the end of the Lakers series and the end of this easy Nugget sweep, by the way. And I understand Denver was wounded, and, you know, obviously no Jamal Murray. Will Barton's on a minutes restriction. Their backcourt was not playoff level. But that same Denver team just beat Portland, you know, went into Portland in a game six and eliminated them. And Portland's has their own offseason questions, obviously, but that's not like a bad team. So, like, Denver was, I mean, they were still capable. And Phoenix, like, that Phoenix led the last three games by 24 seconds, 17 seconds, and 49 seconds the last three games. I mean, it was just complete dominance from end to end. I believe it was like 63 plus 63 in the four games. That was just a different class of teams. And I know Phoenix has not yet been tested by a fully healthy team, and whoever they play in the West Finals will probably be their toughest opponent, considering Davis went out. But I mean, they're rising at the right time. And the fact that Paul looked like this, my biggest question would have been his shoulder, but he has answered that. 37 points. He had nine straight mid-range jumpers last night. He had, 37, which, by the way, is like his most points since 2018. Fred's about to take a victory lap. I can already see it on his face. But he made seven more mid-range jumpers than Denver in that series. They're fun to watch. Devin Booker's an unbelievable scorer. Ayton is rising. We've talked about it. It goes back to the 2015 draft. They got the best player in that draft at 13. That changes the franchise. And then beyond that, they seem to have hit with Ayton, even if they didn't get Doncic. And then Mikal Bridges, what, 10th overall? Like, they've just hit on lottery picks lately. And then that led to this summer where they had an environment that would convince Chris Paul, I want to be there. And Jay Crowder, I want to be there. And that completed their team.
I'm so impressed. He's not the best player on the Suns, because Chris Paul is. But I'm so impressed with DeAndre Ayton. Like, I know we've talked about him on the pod, but he just went up against, like, he's playing real centers. I know Anthony Davis was hurt, But even before Davis was hurt, I mean, we were talking about how good of a job he was doing on Davis in that first round series, even before Davis became
game one, irreparably game hurt. One, he was great against Davis.
Excellent against Davis. Remember, we came on this podcast and we just talked about how he was pushing him into the mid range the whole game. And he made, you know, a million out of a million shots, right? He's been so good. Now he goes up against Jokic, and Jokic had a good series until the very end, right? A good series with an unfortunate ending, but they did a good job taking away his facilitating. They execute so well. Yeah. They execute.
And that was Ayton.
Mm-hmm.
They took away his facilitating because they didn't have to double, because Ayton could just stand him up one-on-one and didn't really get, I mean, he got in a little foul trouble in a couple of the games, but not really.
Yeah.
He was smart with the way he played.
No, he is. And he's going to have a hell of a road if Phoenix ends up going to the finals, because there's a chance where after playing those two centers in the first two rounds, he can end up having to face Rudy Gobert in the conference finals. And if they win that, maybe Joel Embiid in the finals. So we're going to get a real test on DeAndre Ayton, potentially, if Phoenix ends up going all the way here, or at least getting to the finals. And so far, man, like, we knew what Chris Paul was, and we didn't necessarily know what Devin Booker was, but I think we probably all would have bet on Devin Booker being exactly what he's shown being, and we all would have agreed on that. And I think DeAndre Ayton, there was just a little bit of a test, like, okay, let's see what he's made of. His defense has gotten much better over the last 3 years. His counting numbers went down this year, but I thought he became a better player playing alongside Paul and Booker throughout the year. And man, like, he's gone the other way. Like, he's playing incredibly. It's just been really great to see Ayton through this playoff run. I think it's a fabulous story after all kind of the friendly fire he gets caught up in after the Luka pick, which is not his fault. All he's done is come out, improve like crazy, and he's playing the best ball of his life in the most important moments.
I mean, it never gets old analyzing all these what-if scenarios with the draft, but I mean, that one in particular, if you guys remember, you had Igor Kokoskov, you know, who had so many ties to Luka, was the Suns coach at the time, and so they just shocked the world when they went with Ayton. And I think we hit on it last week. You know, he had the performance enhanced setback, and just the narrative around him was so bad early on. I haven't gotten to know him at all, and haven't covered him that closely so far. But right now, in the moment, you talk about joy. Like, man, the dude seems like he's having so much fun. That video that kind of went viral last night of him celebrating with people out in Phoenix, the fans came out like crazy, and he's jumping out of the sunroof of that car and celebrating. And you know, it kind of, they're a fun team, and I'm dying to see if they can keep it going, because, and this goes for a few of the teams that are still alive right now, is that because this is the NBA playoff year where, you know, none of the legacy teams are involved anymore, you have, like, you know, teams kind of reaching new ground all over the place. And so you're going to see more enthusiasm coming out of Phoenix than you would be if the Lakers made the conference finals. You know, AD is not jumping out of a sunroof and celebrating with the fans, but there's a lot of that right now. Clippers Jazz play tonight, so we're not going to get into their stuff. But Phoenix, you know, showing Denver the door. Thoughts from you guys on what, if anything, it means? Because it's a fork in the road, I would argue, of, like, do you just give them a complete pass because they had no Jamal Murray and, you know, no Will Barton and Monte Morris until late? Those types of things that hurt them. Jokic, I felt bad for him, because it's like the MVP curse. He goes out in tough fashion and then loses his cool at the end. Just the optics around his exit were pretty challenging. But once Jamal gets healthy, they still have a very good team that's obviously going to be back at it next year.
Denver, like, some problems popped up in that series. Aaron Gordon did nothing, really. His last three games were 4 points, 6 points, 8 points. 8 of 25 shooting. He made zero threes in the entire series. Michael Porter Jr. Has promise, obviously, and is probably going to be stepping into an extension that's going to be pricey. But he made defensive errors for a lot of the series. He doesn't really create. He had 4 total assists in 4 games. And we're talking about, you know, you lose Jamal Murray, like, Jokic is doing his thing, and obviously he's the hub of the offense, but you want this rising number two who you think is Michael Porter Jr. Like, hey, it's your time. Like, come in, like, show out in this series. Maybe, you know, do a little bit more play creation for others. He kind of was a glorified spot-up shooter in that series. And, you know, he scored 15, 11, 15, 20. Like, so, you know, his shot is unbelievably pretty. He's probably going to make, you know, 200 threes per season for the next decade. But there's just a lot more to his game. He needs to get better. And that was on full display in the series. And that's the two things I'm looking at, right? Because Gordon was like, they were always going to have an issue at the guard position in that series, but they needed to be much better at the wings. And to be honest, Mikal Bridges was the best wing in that series. And that's a big problem from a Denver perspective, because Gordon and Porter are their third and fourth most important players going forward, and they kind of flamed out.
Yeah, a lot of their problems are just based on the fact that they're extremely reliant on Jamal Murray for playmaking and offensive creation, and they didn't have him. You know, when you don't have guards and you have to rely on MPJ to create, yeah, you're right. It's not his strength. The other part was that, and this was a problem in the Portland series too, Their perimeter defense is just not there, and I feel like that's something that they're gonna have to make an objective. Like if I'm running the Nuggets, that's my number one objective. We got to find some ways to tighten up the perimeter defense and bring in somebody who can lock guys down and specifically guard screens. I mean, they just got hung up on screens left and right in both series. I mean, that's how Dame is getting switches and then just going to town and stepping back against everybody, right? And you know, I think that's something where, you know, obviously it's a little more difficult to implement when your injured guys are back, and you know, you gotta play Murray, you gotta play Barton, and those are guys who are going to come out and they're going to take minutes, and they're going to, you know, obviously give you a little bit more, at least in a size perspective, than someone like Campazzo. But in terms of shoring up the perimeter defense, Aaron Gordon did a lot in the regular season to help. Nuggets got off to a really bad defensive start this year and got better throughout the year. That's something where, like, that's a core that can be a title contender for sure if it's healthy. And if they can just shore up some of the defensive issues there on the perimeter, I think that could help them a ton going into next year.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I'm going to end on this note, gentlemen. I'm going to skip over a little bit Bucks Nets. They play tomorrow when this pod's coming out, and we'll see. I mean, that thing is obviously taking a turn. We went from getting ready to kind of write about Mike Budenholzer's future to the Bucks being back in the game, and Kyrie going down, James Harden going down, Kevin Durant, you know, all of a sudden, you know, trying to kind of take the weight of the world with the Nets and keep it going. We'll see what happens there. But Fred, I think you wanted to, you know, come at me over my Donovan Mitchell take. I tweeted the other day that I thought Donovan Mitchell was the best player in the playoffs to this point. My only timing disclaimer will be that was entering game three. The Jazz were 6-0 at that point. But there's been some incredible individual play. And so we were going to have a little fun with with a top five or pick a few of these guys, who would you highlight, my friend, as the supreme playoff performer at this point?
All right. So I actually made a top five.
Yes. Here we go.
Because I just want to humiliate you with it. Should I start? Should I start at one or should I start at five?
I will decide more dramatic? I'm humiliated, first of all, and I'll never admit it. Yeah.
what's more dramatic? Do I start at five or one?
Definitely five.
Definitely five. All right. Yeah. Five was really hard. I had the exact same problem that I had when I put together my all NBA ballot, which is I didn't know if I should choose Lillard or Luka. And I went back and forth about 15 times. And
I want to build it up a little more. Is just kind of spoiler alert. Is Donovan in your top five? Did he make your top five?
Yes. He made the top five.
Okay. All right. Good to know.
He made the top five. So I considered not putting him in the top five, not because it was correct, but only to try to embarrass you more than I already could.
I'm so relieved.
So I ended up going with Luka. I thought Dame's job was a little bit easier than Luka's job in that he was going up against all those injured Nuggets guards, and Luka had to go up against the Clippers defense in that first round, even though he didn't make his free throws and let go of a 2-0 lead. They were both incredible. I don't think there's a wrong answer there. Number four, I went with Donovan Mitchell, who has been excellent, but I thought not as good as Kawhi Leonard, who has absolutely feasted throughout the playoffs, is the reason why the Clippers came back from 2-0 in the first round. He's shooting 66%.
Why they always gotta get down 2-0, Fred? Why they always gotta get down 2-0?
Not because of him. He is shooting 66% on two pointers. That's what like a center who takes six shots a game and only dunks shoots on two pointers.
First of all, can I just clarify? Did you in my defense, did you make your list after Clippers Jazz game three, correct?
Yeah. Yes, I made my list. I made it.
Would Kawhi still have been one before Clippers Jazz game three?
Oh, Kawhi's not one. Kawhi's three.
Oh, okay.
We're going up the ladder. I've got KD too, because he's shooting 50, 40, 90 on 31 a game, and is Kevin Durant.
He's about to get heavily tested. Yes. in the coming days
by Tucker.
PJ Tucker.
PJ Tucker was great in game four.
PJ Tucker is Fred Katz's number one player on this list. You know, it's not. It's not Giannis. At least it's not for me.
No, I have. I made honorable mentions too, so that people on Twitter don't get mad at me for disrespecting their guys. Number one is Joel Embiid. I am totally set on Joel Embiid being the best player in the playoffs. The 76ers are scoring 133 points per 100 possessions when Joel Embiid is on the floor. He is a one-man offense right now. He has walked up to Clint Capella, who is an excellent defender, and just annihilated him, and he's hurt. He's just unstoppable right now. I don't know what in the world you do against Joel Embiid.
Fred, I feel like you didn't say anything that's really in dispute. So that part is, you know, kudos to you. You're always fantastic at breaking down the game. I feel like this is a microcosm of the eternal debate about MVP versus, like, Rachel Nichols is constantly campaigning for a best performer award, individual kind of stat driven. I mean, because to me with Donovan, it's this: if you want to focus on value again heading into game three, to see the position that the Jazz were in after losing game one to Memphis, and obviously everything that went with Donovan's frustration because he thought he was ready to play and they didn't let him play. So they have a scare, you know, the 18 comes in, steals the game. They're a little nervous. And then they just obliterate the Grizzlies from there with Donovan leading the way. Then losing Mike Conley and the idea that you're going up on a pretty talented Clippers team that is supposed to be and is superstar laden, you know, without your backcourt mate and a guy who's had a fantastic year and is so important to what they do. That is that kind of value. I don't think anybody has had to that point had the impeccable record that Donovan did. And, you know, right now, game three, you saw, again, we're not really going down Clippers Jazz road too much, but you saw, you know, maybe call it fatigue, call it now it's been three games without Mike Conley and Donovan, you know, came on strong in the second half, but he was scoreless in the first quarter. And, you know, they had doubles on him that he said he hadn't seen since high school. And it's getting tougher and tougher, and we'll see where his postseason goes. But he continues to prove, wherever he is in anybody's rankings, he continues to prove himself to be a fantastic playoff performer. He's one of those guys whose game so far, you know, every postseason has elevated on this stage. And there's so many guys whose games go the other way, and maybe 10 or 12% less production. Donovan goes the other way. You know, he meets the moment, and I love his competitiveness. I love his passion. I love his leadership. I think he's a special dude. And it's wild to see with Dwayne Wade now, obviously part of the Jazz ownership group. It's such a kind of a cool vibe there too, because he really did. There's so many moments with Donovan.
They're having in-game conversations. Yeah, he's Donovan like coming over in the middle of the second Wade. Quarter. Yeah,
I mean, like the barreling to the rim, the, you know, sliding out of bounds and, you know, winding up behind the stanchion, and just that fervor that he plays the game with is very D Wade-esque.
It's odd to see D Wade like in a Jazz hat in the arena, like really super into the Jazz.
I'm
like,
looking at the camera and saying, "Hey, make sure you watch the Cube tonight at 8 p.m." His new life.
He's good at branding, and honestly, terrific choice by the Utah ownership group to bring D Wade under the umbrella.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just added kind of some juice to just like the whole scene. It's cool. It is cool to see Donovan Mitchell in the middle of the second quarter go over, and D Wade's like telling him, like, "Hey, maybe you angle your drive that way."
Right.
And you're like, oh, you know,
classic cog from ownership telling the players. Just a
unbelievable. This meddling. Yeah. Are you kidding? Quinn Snyder cannot have this.
I told someone the other day, and this is up your alley, Slater. I was like, yeah, it's not quite the same vibe as, like, you know, Klay Thompson fist pounding Joe Lacob, you know, a couple years ago in the playoffs. We're also normally programmed to hear, like, minority owners in the NBA are typically, you know, the masters of kind of subversion and, you know, and frustration, where they always are mad they don't have enough power. And this, you know, having synergy like this is not normal. It is a pretty wise move, I think, on Ryan Smith's part. I think the Jazz are helping the optics around their organization because of it. But as far as Donovan goes, again, we'll see what happens in that series. But he's been great. All the other guys you mentioned have been great. With Kawhi, man, Fred, I always have a hard time judging Kawhi, because I know, I mean, the efficiency is incredible. I still think he hasn't missed a shot in the fourth quarter of their wins. I think that's an actual real stat, which is pretty wild. By the way, Slater, you hear that he didn't even mention Chris Paul on this list? Just want to, you know.
He's on the honorable mentions, one honorable mention above
the third best player on the Suns. Yeah, no,
yeah. The guy with like a, you know, 100 to 1 assist to turnover ratio or whatever it is.
He was, I mean, as little of an impact as he had on the Lakers series, I could hear the argument that he was the best player for the Suns in the Nuggets sweep.
Oh, yeah. You look at the shooting line, he shot 63, 75, 100 against the Nuggets.
Right.
Outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, fourth quarters too. I think he was 16 and 19 in the fourth quarters. He was just, he closed. But, you know, at the same time, what did Booker finish with last night? Like 30 something.
34.
Just easy.
Yeah, well, Chris doesn't score like that. I just looked it up a second ago. That was Chris's second highest scoring total ever in the playoffs.
Since, yeah. 41 in his highest. His career high. He hadn't scored 37. He scored 41 against the Jazz to close them out for the Rockets in 2018.
Right.
But since that, he hadn't scored even 37 regular season or playoffs since the Clippers days. You know, so yeah, he's not really that type of scorer. But I'm not sure I've ever seen 9 straight mid range makes over like a quarter period.
I watched your clip.
On the same side of the floor.
Yeah, your clip was wild, man. You hear guys constantly talk about, I got to get to my spot, and you don't normally take it literally. And I was watching that video clip that you put together with Chris, and I'm just thinking, like, wow, like he's literally targeting that spot every single time.
He's like snaking through the lane. He's like, gotta get to, like, it's like, you know, if you played a game or where there's hot spots on the floor.
Yeah.
7 points. He was like, I gotta dribble over to the 7 point spot.
Shoot. Like the video game, and there's like a bonus in that spot. He's gotta get to it. All right, guys, I'm going to let you bounce on that. I got to get on, move on. I'm down in L.A. covering the series. It's very strange to be on the road again, but it's been nice back out there again tonight and covering these playoffs. Keep up the good work. Appreciate you both, as always, and we will talk to you next week.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.